Well, it's a delight here to be with you, and I really hope that's how I feel. And I'm sort of rather hoping for a miracle that you'll be feeling that by the time we get to the end of this time together. As someone has very famously said, laughter is the best medicine, but it is good to remember that if you do laugh for no reason at all, you probably need medicine. What I'm going to be doing this day while I'm with you is I'm going to be trying to look at some of the major cultural things that I see as around the world. And certainly this morning, this afternoon, we're going to be looking at the same problem from two very different angles. So if you know people who come to the afternoon service, you sometimes compare notes. I wouldn't bother doing it at the end of today because I'll be saying something totally different to them, although I do think that the two subject matters, although totally different, do actually join. So this afternoon, we'll be looking at what is increasingly being referred to around the world as victim culture. I was recently reading this in a book entitled Destructive Trends in Mental Health, published by an academic press in 2005. There's a nice encouraging trend for you title. But in it, they were quoting a sociologist from 1987 who was at the University of Georgetown in the United States. And this is what the sociologist was saying 30 years ago. He said, "Fighting for our rights all too often means claiming victim status. Ironically, the rights movement often victimizes one group while liberating another. What seems to be a noble, justified, long overdue act of protecting a victim can easily turn to blame warfare. And when this happens, conflict, injustice, and victimization are perpetuated, and the possibility of resolution and healing is completely destroyed." And it's interesting that this theme is now being picked up by people all over the world, but that's what I'll be talking about this afternoon. We won't be looking at that now. Instead, what we'll be looking at now is another issue, but it is linked. Over the last few years, I've had the huge privilege to speak to groups of leaders in almost every single continent of the world, with the exception of Antarctica. I can include New Zealand in that, because apparently, if the geologists are right, and now New Zealandia is a new continent, then I have been to all of them apart from that, apart from Antarctica. But if you obviously define your continents politically or culturally, then there may be only four or five continents, in which case I have been to all of them. But anyway, let's not go down that dispute. It's not something I want to be talking to you about now. What I do want to be talking about is the huge sense of loss of peace that we seem to be having in our world right now. All of us around the world seem to be on this search to find internal, external, and eternal peace. We're looking for some kind of resolution. And what has struck me is that every major corporate group I've spoken in around the world in the last 2 years or so, and every right across northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, or as far as west as you can go, as far as east you can go, they've all, when they've had the opportunity to say, "We'd like you to speak on this," they've all given me the same subject matter. So it says something when every political group you get to speak to, every business group you get to speak to, says, "We'd like you to answer the same question." And it gets you asking, why? Why is it you are asking me to answer the same question everywhere I go? Because the theme that all of them have picked up for me, asked me to address, was the issue of reconciliation. What does it mean to bring about reconciliation within a people? Now, this is partly driven, especially for political leader sense, in that almost every country I know of in the world and every country I've visited in the last 2 years, which is roughly about 80, all of them have movements within them to split into multiple other countries. Now, I'm not just thinking within the United Kingdom of Scottish independence. As a matter of fact, there are six independence groups in the UK at the moment, and if they all get their will, in a couple of years' time, the UK will be six different countries. And it's not just what we're seeing in Spain right now with Catalonia. That's not the only movement within Spain that's pushing for its own independence. Every single country that I know of in the world right now has a significant movement in it to shatter into multiple smaller pieces. Because everybody feels that's maybe the only way to get the kind of peace and fulfillment they're looking for. The question is why? Why is it that corporate leaders are also struggling to find out what does it mean to actually hold a group of people together? Is there anything that binds us together? There are all kinds of stats produced in this world today, and one of the stats that sometimes gets pushed out is people look at what kind of poetry is being quoted, what kind of songs, what kind of literature, what are people going to? And there's one piece, one poem that's been quoted more often than any other piece of poetry in the last 2 months by a massive margin. You're not talking percentages, you're talking multiples. And it's a very famous poem that contains the line, "The center cannot hold." And the reason why it seems to be quoted across Asia, Middle East, Africa, Europe, North America, South America, is that one line seems to sum up so much of what's going on. The center cannot hold. What is it that actually holds us together? Regardless of whatever divisions that we may have, what holds us together? Now, this lack of peace that we feel seems to be coming at us from multiple directions. there is a very personal sense of lack of peace where we often feel that somehow something's gone wrong with us or maybe to us. We feel very uneasy about intimacy for that reason. I don't know if any of you have read any books by a guy called Franzen. Any of you read any of Franzen's novels? Okay, two or three people nodding their heads. Well, one of the latest books that he wrote is called Purity. And that purity is not a concept, it's a person. And this lady, she is looking for something she's not really quite sure, but she has this fractured existence. And the way the novel starts is incredible. She's sitting in a coffee shop, I think it might be a Starbucks, but anyway, it's a coffee shop, and a guy walks in and she likes him. And she gets talking to him, and very quickly she asks herself this question. She says, "Dare I risk the intimacy of friendship, or shall I retreat into the relative safety of casual sex? Dare I risk the intimacy of friendship, or shall I retreat into the relative safety of casual sex?" In other words, I know I'm looking for something, and I'm looking for something to fulfill me. And this is where, as a culture, we've got totally disorientated, and we completely confuse the categories of being physically intimate with having relational intimacy. And we think it's actually possible to feed one with the other, which is why so many people are empty, because you can have as much sex as you want and find yourself completely bankrupt on the relational side, and you feel totally alone. On the other hand, it's entirely possible to be leading a non-sexually active life and have it filled with very rich friendship. But that's a message that we find very hard to believe in our global culture of today. So we have this thing that's going on within us. Now, not only that, we also see huge economic turmoil going on right now. I don't know if any of you have read a book by a guy, a French economist called Piketty. If you haven't bought it, I'd recommend buying it. It's about 1,200 pages. Put it on your bookshelf. It looks A, impressive, and B, is a very good self-defense weapon should someone break into your house. And C, if you offer for cremated, it's so big they could even be buried in it. Now, what Piketty says, and it's very much critiqued and sometimes, you know, legitimately and so on, but what his basic thesis is this, is that the rate of return on capital around the world has far outstripped the rate of return on income. What does that mean? That means if you're a middle-class person living in any major metropolis around the world, the number one question you have and you ask yourself, especially if you have kids or if you're in your mid-30s, is how on earth will I ever be able to afford to buy my own house? In other words, capital appreciation, as the way the global economy has worked, has moved to a point where most people don't see themselves being able to have a long-term future in it. And when you start to exclude people from the political ownership of any economy, people begin to start to feel disenfranchised. They feel disadvantaged. And all of a sudden, all kinds of other things begin to happen, and we begin asking and struggling at all kinds of levels and in all kinds of ways for all kinds of reasons. So this is also going on right now. But not only that, we even have a huge historical challenge that is facing us. I don't know if any of you read another book. I think it came out 1-2 years ago by the guy who actually just won the Booker Prize for Literature, a guy called Ishiguro. But Ishiguro writes very slowly. He writes, I think he's written, 8 books in the last 25, 30 years or so. He does a lot of research, and he puts a lot of work in, and these books just come out very slow. They're all worth reading. And if you've never read Never Let Me Go, and you want to read a short book that will keep you awake at night and stop you from sleeping, I thoroughly recommend that. It's like high-class literary horror. But his latest book got universally panned by almost every critic I read. As a matter of fact, it got panned so much by the critics, I almost didn't bother reading it myself. It's called The Buried Giant. But I was in an airport one day, and I saw the book, and I thought, gosh, I really like this guy. I'm going to read it. And I can remember by the time I got to the end of that book thinking that perhaps this book was one of the most insightful and prophetic novels I've read in quite a long time. It's an incredibly slow-moving book. Everything happens in it slowly. My kids have recently gone through a stage because I've now hit that age where I'm obviously way, way older than them, 35. And so they're like asking me questions like, "Dad, you know, what music did you listen to? What movies did you watch?" And so I've had an awful lot of fun playing them stuff, and they go, "Ooh, the Eagles, we like that song, Desperado. Can you play it again?" and stuff like that. You see, some of you know what that means, and others are going, "Who? What? That doesn't make any sense whatsoever." And one of the fun things has been showing them the Clint Eastwood movies that I absolutely loved growing up, because they move so slowly. So incredibly slowly. And this book moves at that kind of pace. But it is an incredible book. It starts off with this elderly couple, and they can't even remember the recent past. Forget about remembering years ago, decades ago. They can't remember clearly into the last few weeks. they're having a conversation and they're trying to remember if they ever had children, but they're not sure. They think that maybe they did, but they just can't remember. And they're living in a state of forgetfulness. The novel's set in the United Kingdom, medieval Britain, and everyone is living in this state of forgetfulness. And they set off on a quest to re-find their memory, to rediscover who they are. And as they travel through the country, they get together with a whole group of very unlikely people from all over. And this very unlikely band of people end up on this quest. And I don't want to destroy the end of the book for you if you haven't been able to read it yet, although there will be a very small spoiler alert. They do, towards the end of the book, find what is causing a national state of self-forgetfulness. And they're now standing there thinking, shall we help everyone recover their memory? Shall we do something which will allow everybody here to remember the past? And as they're standing there debating it, there's a warrior figure who has joined them. And the warrior says, if you do this, if you allow people to recover the past, quick-tongued men will make ancient grievance rhyme with current complaint, and the result will be war and mayhem. If you do this, as we recover our past and all the terrible things that have happened in our past, that collective sense of peace we have now will be lost. Because quick-tongued men will make ancient grievance rhyme with current complaint. In other words, we'll blame all of our ills in the present on everything that happened in the past, and the result will be war and mayhem. And now they find themselves debating, what do we do? Is it better to help people to recover the past and cease to live in peace? Or is it better somehow to let the past just be murky, but we can somehow all live together? And that one sense, that is the buried giant of 21st century global culture. The more we learn about our past, the more we learn about the terrible narratives of what happened in the past as previous generations exploited and took advantage of one another. Do we bring all of that now into the present? What does it mean to truly find peace today? And I'm going to delve into the answer to that this afternoon. What I want to look at now, what I'd like to look at now is in such a place, in such a culture, in such a world, what does the person of Christ, what does the Bible have to say about any of this? Because this is our overwhelming challenge. This is the overwhelming wrestle that almost all people are wrestling with right now. Which is, and we see it, we don't see it in our politics anymore, which is why recently in the Financial Times, one political commentator wrote, this is a couple of years ago, he said, the politics of the future is not about right versus left. It's about establishment versus anti-establishment. The question is, do we have to destroy everything and bring everything down, like you bulldoze a building? Or is it possible somehow to renovate? I'm using this language because I'm speaking in England and I know most of you are probably watching too many TV development programs and cookery shows. I don't watch cookery shows, I just eat the result because I've got all the evidence to prove it. And so, into that context, I'd like to tell you a story that Jesus Christ himself told. And it is a fascinating story. It's midway through a big dialogue that Jesus is having. He's been sat with a whole group of people, and they're talking about helping the poorest of the poor. And Jesus says, look, when you have a party, don't invite around everybody you want to impress to make favors with them. When you're extending hospitality, invite around the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. Invite those kinds of people. They have no hope of repaying you. They can't do anything for you. They can't help you. They can't promote you. They can't take you forward in any way. But you make it your business to help them. And if you do, I promise you, you will be repaid at the banquet at the resurrection of the righteous. In other words, Jesus says, there will come a time when God will come back. And everybody will be raised from death into life again. And we will all be there. And then there will be a banquet. Now, the banquet which is going to be held is an interesting type of banquet. It's very interesting when you ask Christians what happens at the end of the world. They'll often talk about judgment and a new heaven and a new earth and all having new bodies, because especially today we all want to have new bodies. It's the result of all those cookery programs we're watching. And it goes on and on and on and on. The very last thing most Christians ever mention is the fact there'll be a marriage, which is interesting, isn't it? Most Christians have forgotten that they're going to get married at the end of the world. Jesus Christ will come back for his bride. Imagine you're having coffee with someone in a coffee shop and they suddenly go, oh, it's Sunday. Is it really 11:45? I'm getting married today. And they ran out. I mean, what would you think psychologically of such a person? You may be sitting there hoping secretly that they missed the wedding, because from the looks of it, the person would actually be spared if the person who's going to be their spouse didn't make it. It says something, doesn't it? It says something about someone if they completely forget they're going to get married. And what does it say about the church if most Christians aren't thinking about their marriage anymore? Have you ever met someone who's got engaged, about to get married? Have you ever tried changing the subject to anything else apart from the wedding? I mean, it's impossible. Doesn't matter what you say. It's a lovely day. Oh, I hope it will be nice on my wedding. You know, the weather's looking bad right now, isn't it? Yes, yes, yes. I'm hoping it will improve for the wedding. You know, this is great pizza. Ooh, you should see the food we're going to have at the wedding. I mean, it doesn't matter how often you try to change the subject matter, it will come back. So the context is they're talking about the banquet that will be thrown by God himself on the day of resurrection. And when someone hears Jesus Christ talk about that, about the banquet that will be thrown when God comes back to this world, someone says, blessed is the person who has a seat at that banquet. In other words, the sentiment is, imagine being at the top table at that event. I mean, just imagine what that would be like. All the dead are brought back to life. So you've got all the living and the dead. You've got billions and billions of people. Imagine being in a place of honor at a banquet like that. Now, you have to admit, that's going to be pretty cool. I'm sure you've all been invited to weddings where you're stuck on the nobody table. You know, table, you know, 72 all the way over in the back, you know, halfway around the corner, you know, and so on. But it's special, isn't it, when you're sat right up there at the front. It's a way that we honor someone. Does that make sense? We signal, hey, you're important to me. This is valuable to me. There's a significance here in terms of our connection, whether it's to do with biological identity or cultural importance, whatever it may be, I want to honor this. And someone says, imagine how happy you would be to be put in a place of significance around that table, which is amazing, isn't it? Now, having gone to town on this illustration, I now need to undo it. Because when Jesus talks about, the guy doesn't say, blessed is the person who has a seat at that table. Because the word table isn't there. And the word seat isn't there. In this kind of culture, to this day, if you go in these places, what you'll see is, actually there's a little carpet on the floor here. What will happen is there's normally like a mosaic in the middle of the floor. That's your table. All the food goes on that. You sit on cushions, okay, with your feet tucked under you all the way around the edges of it. And you recline. And the idea is that you're reclining, does that make sense? You know, on one side, you eat with one hand. You take bread and you eat everything, all the delicacies which are prepared. And you're a reclined guest. The reason for that is that you can't get everybody reclining around there, so you have everybody else stands around the edges of the room. So basically, blessed is the person who is reclining at that feast. And then Jesus goes on to tell this incredible story. He says, a certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who'd been invited, come, everything is ready. So do you get the setting for it? Supremely happy, blessed is the person who gets invited to attend the banquet at the resurrection of the righteous, when all the really good people are raised up to life. And someone goes, wow, imagine being good enough to be there for that. And Jesus says, okay, I'm now going to tell you a story about a great man who throws a great banquet. Now, this is where the cultural cue may miss you, so I'll just have to explain it a little bit. If you read what the story that Jesus tells very carefully, you'll see that the invitation to the banquet and the preparation of the food happen simultaneously. So, as the invitation goes out, he prepares the food. Now, why? Well, all cultures are slightly different here. If I were to invite you to come and have dinner at my house, let's say 6 months from now, and in 6 months from now, you wake up that morning and you think, oh, I don't really feel like going, it's hard to get out of it, isn't it? You've been committed for a long time. But if I saw you here and I said, hey, why don't we grab a bite to eat after the final service tonight? And you say, yeah, sure. And then about a couple of hours later, you think, oh, you know what, I'm feeling a bit tired. I've got a big day tomorrow. You feel it's culturally acceptable, don't you? To send me a text and say, actually, you know what? I don't think I can do it this time. Why don't we do it next time? That's okay. Now, in the Middle East, it's in reverse. You can make long-term commitments. They mean nothing at all. But when you promise that day you will come, now you're culturally obliged to come. There is no acceptable way out for you. You have to come. Does that make sense? It was on the day, it was there, and you prepare the food. Now, in a culture where there's no refrigeration, as you prepare the food, everything has to be eaten or it's thrown out. So it's not like you can do all the preparation. So what happens is as people say yes, you keep preparing enough food because you can't possibly run out of food because that's the most embarrassing thing that can happen to a Middle Eastern host. You must have more than enough, right? So that everybody has their fill and you stuff everybody silly. Okay? That's what they say about all of us who live in that part of the world. You know, we build houses like we're going to live forever and we eat like there's no tomorrow. You culturally, you have to make sure there's enough for everybody to have. So if the guests don't come, you're in trouble. So Jesus says there was a guy who prepared, who hosted a great banquet and invited many guests. And at the time the banquet was ready, he sent those who had been invited, come, everything is now ready. In other words, when the guy goes out to tell everyone, come, the food is ready, he's not inviting them to come. He's saying, hey, I've invited you, you said you were coming, ding, 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 dinner time. He's ringing the dinner bell. And as he's ringing the dinner bell, hey, the food is ready, come to my master's house. People begin to make excuses. They begin to make excuses about why they can't come to the banquet. Now, this is a very, very strange thing to anyone who's lived in this culture because you just don't do that. And so Jesus says, look, the first guy said, I've just brought a field. I have to go and see it. So please excuse me. Now, the question is this believable? And the answer is no. Because the buying and selling of land takes a huge amount of time. You don't just roll up, see a field, and buy it that afternoon. Okay, you're in a long-term negotiation. You find out everything about the guy's family and his family tree. Well, why do you do that? Because if you're related in any way, you make an appeal to his sense of honor. And you say to him, you're not cheating me, are you? My great-great-grandmother and your great-great-grandfather, they were connected, blah-de-blah, through this kind of marriage. Are you giving me a fair price? There aren't little maps, with little lines drawn around the plots of land for you to see from a distance. You have to actually go and see it. You're just looking at a rugged terrain. There are no fences. There are no markers, there are no nothing. So you just simply say, okay, that path, is it on the edge of the line? Does it run through my field? That big rock over there, whose is it? That dead tree stump. And that's how you figure out the piece of land. So the idea that somehow, since having said, yes, you're coming to dinner, that you've gone and sought a piece of land and brought a piece of land, make sense? And now you can't come, it's like crazy. That would be me like saying to you, oh, I'm really, really sorry. I know I said I was coming for dinner tonight, but I've just bought a car. I've got no idea if it's a Skoda or a Ferrari. I'm just off to go and look at it. And now, if that was my excuse, what would you make of that? Well, you would have to conclude one of two things. Either A, I'm a moron. That word moron, by the way, is a Greek word. You find it in the Bible. Moron. It means to be a moron. Either A, I'm a moron. Only a moron would buy a car and not know if it was a Skoda or Ferrari. Okay? You'd have to know it, right? Or B, that if I was lying to you, I'm still a moron because only a moron would think that anyone else would believe that excuse. Does that make sense? Either way, you're stupid. Here we see some of Jesus Christ's humor coming through. He's at a dinner party. He tells his story. As he delivers this line, people would burst out laughing. I mean, it is utterly ridiculous and incredible to believe that anyone would think or say something like that. Now, having just met the world's most stupid person, but Jesus goes on to say, but another said, I've just brought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm going to go and try them out. Please excuse me. Now, is this believable? Well, you always buy oxen in pairs. You need 2 of them because you have what's called a yoke. It's like a piece of fashioned wood. Okay, and you put 1 ox on one side, 1 ox on the other. So if you sell or buy oxen, you go, they have a little pen, they have all the animals in it, they have a plow, they'll normally prepare a strip of land. You pick out 2 animals, you put the plow on, you pull a line. Do they go to the left or do they go to the right? You observe it like that. And then you go to one end and then you take 1 oxen off, you put another oxen off, and then you come back and you keep plowing lines up and down till you find 2. You always buy them in pairs. Okay, because they pull equally, they have to work side by side. So the idea you've just brought 5 oxen, and now you're going to go try them after you bought them. We now have a new number one moron. We thought we met number one, but he's just been displaced through record sales. It's unbelievable. How could someone do this? This would be like a child saying, I know you asked me, for my homework, but my dog ate it. And the teacher says, yes, but you didn't do your homework last week because your dog died. Do you know what I mean? I mean, there's just no way that this is culturally believable. It is simply impossible. It can't be done. It can't be done. Then the third guy comes along, and he says, I've just got married, I can't come. Now, first of all, a word to the theologically educated amongst you. I've heard some people in some places around the world say, well, look, if you get married in this culture, you're excused from military service and going to fight and all that kind of stuff, and so, you know, this is a good excuse. The guy hasn't been invited to war. Okay, that's not what they've been invited to. They've been invited to dinner. They said they were coming to dinner. Make sense? And now he's changing his mind at the last minute. Now, in this kind of setting, it's impossible to have two feasts competing with each other. Jesus tells the story about a city without walls. That's the technical term he uses as he described the setting of the city. That means no walls. So there are huge cities in this part of the world. And if you ever go to Jerusalem or something like that, you can see what a giant walled city looks like. I mean, it's massive. And if you go to Jerusalem today, you have to remember it's much smaller now than it was in its heyday because a lot of the wall isn't there anymore. Does that make sense? The wall was rebuilt with a smaller perimeter at one point or a large part of it. So there are huge cities. But a city without walls, these are small settlements. And you can't have two conflicting feasts at the same time. It's impossible. It can't be done. When you get married, you invite everybody you know. I mean, everybody. Everybody who is loosely connected to you gets invited, which is why, if you're in this part of the world, you can go to a wedding uninvited. If you don't want to cook, you just wait for the weekend, you just go to weddings, and you just eat. There are going to be 5,000, 10,000 people there. Okay, you just drift in, you have food, you shake everyone's hand, you leave. Nobody's got any clue. Now, my wife and I, we got married in England. Hey, I've got all this Middle Eastern side to me. My wife's English. We had a big wedding by English standards, about 200 people. We fed 200 people. Okay, that is minuscule compared to a normal village wedding. My wedding probably would have had, if we'd gone to Cyprus, maybe 15 to 20,000 people because we know an awful lot of people. You can't get a hotel ballroom for 20,000 people. You go back to your mother's village, you take over the town square. You close all the roads going into the town square because that's where everyone's going to eat. Okay, all of your female relatives who are close to you come and peel potatoes for 3 days. Do you have any idea how long it takes to peel potatoes for 15,000 people? That is a lot of people. All the men come and they cook all the meat. It's the only time they cook because they can play with fire, right? So you're cooking, you're slow cooking pork, you're slow cooking beef, and obviously for all the vegetarians who come in, you also slow cook lamb as well. It takes a long, long, long time. So the idea that somehow this guy got married and this other guy threw a great banquet at the same time and they've somehow clashed, that's not possible. He's not saying I got married today. He's saying, look, I'm recently married, and I've got certain desires I want to have fulfilled. And I've been thinking about it tonight. And to be perfectly honest, I'd much rather be fulfilling those desires than having dinner with you. Now, we live in a fairly brazen culture today. But still, in many parts of the United Kingdom, it's still not culturally accepted to say, yeah, I know I said I was coming for dinner, but I've decided I'm going to be having sex instead. That still isn't, by and large, culturally permissible. It's not allowed. And in the time of Christ, this excuse would be seen as insulting. No one would actually, for them, this is not a love. This is unbelievable that someone would say this. It's incredible. Now, why is this so important? The banquet which is thrown for the resurrection of the righteous is a banquet which is there to celebrate reconciliation and unity. Something has happened, and God has done something to make it possible for us to be one with ourselves, one with others, and one with Him. That's what happens in a marriage ceremony. Two become one. They are united together. So at the feast, in order to celebrate this coming together, this peace, this unity, people are making excuses not to be there. Which is why, when you read the story, the servant comes back and reports it to the master, the owner of the house becomes angry. Well, of course the master becomes angry. These excuses are ridiculous. They're insults. They're lies. They're not even believable. They are totally unbelievable. So now the servant gets new instructions from his master. The master says, you go into the streets and alleys of the town, okay, this small, you know, city without walls, and you bring in the poor. They don't go buying land, they don't have any money to buy it with. You go and find the lame, they don't go proving oxen, they cannot walk. You go and find the blind, no one marries them, they cannot work. You find all of those people and you bring them here. And the master says, for I tell you, okay, not a single seat will be left open. So the servant now goes to within his community. Does that make sense? Within the people he knows. And he finds all of the people who aren't so self-righteously important, they think they have a good excuse not to come. He finds all the people who think they're totally undeserving to come. Now, I don't have time to talk about this now. This will be for this afternoon. But self-righteous anger lies at the heart of so much of what's going on in our culture right now. There are terrible injustices in this world. And they seem to be getting worse. Self-righteous anger says, I'm so much better, morally better and superior than everybody else, I'm fully justified in venting all of my anger and hatred against them. But that doesn't bring about lasting peace. That brings about revenge. Lasting peace comes when people say, you know what? I'm just as prone to make just as many mistakes as what all these other people are doing. But it's still wrong. It's wrong for them and it's wrong for me. I know I'm sorry for the bit I've done wrong. You should be sorry for the bit you've done wrong, and I'm going to be working to make this place better. How about you? There are two very different types of cries for justice in this world. One brings peace and the other one is just an excuse to vent. So here we have all of these self-righteous people excusing them coming from this grand celebration. And all the people who thought they weren't worthy, that they never deserved to come, they find themselves being brought. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to any Middle Eastern banquets, but in the Middle East, if someone of great power invites you to come to their house, culture often requires you to refuse. So what you have to do is you have to say, no, 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 I'm not worthy to come. And they will say, no, no, come. And you say, no, 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 really, I can't come. I don't want to be, cause any difficulties for you. You have so many others who are coming. And you can sometimes literally see people being dragged into banquets. It's a way for the master to say, no, I really want you. I mean it. I'm not just inviting you for any other reason. I want you. Now, we have to be very careful here, because if you're a Christian and you're listening to this, you should be recognizing something right now. Because Jesus Christ, in this passage, is talking about his own vision for mission. Jesus Christ says, if you want to know what it is like to be on a Christian mission, to be involved in sharing your faith, this is what it's like. You're going to go out into a world and you're going to hear some of the most ridiculous excuses you've ever heard not to come. Some of them are going to be wrong-headed, some of them will be insults, some of them will be lies. And you're going to have to be able to deal with that. But there are going to be other people who won't come because they feel they're simply not worthy to come. They feel that somehow they're just messed up or they're just too low down, this simply can't be for them. You're going to have to compel them. You're going to have to keep going to them until they actually realize this is meant for them. Now, during the time of the Spanish Inquisition, this particular parable in Luke 14 was used to justify a very interesting missionary strategy where Jesus said, go out and compel them to come. What they did is they would find people who didn't believe in God. They'd attach them to something like a rack, and they'd begin stretching them. And as they stretched them, eventually their eyes would be opened to the love and mercy of God. And they would say, I believe. And they would walk out of the room, Christian, and a couple of inches taller than they went in. Hopefully today we would question the veracity of that strategy. That is not what Jesus Christ is talking about here. He's saying you're going to have to be compelling. Your words, your life, your actions, how you live, how you speak, what you do, it has to be compelling. People have to look at it and see and feel compelled. You mean this. This is true. I can see this is real for you. I can see this matters for you. I can see this is not just, hey, would you like to come along and have a drink with me tonight? This is something which is really big. There is something utterly compelling about you. The servant has to be compelling. So that people know they can come. Now, in other cultures, you have to sometimes repeat things multiple times for people to know that you mean it. It's not a question about feeling worthy. It's a question about just feeling polite. So I know in Middle East, when my eldest uncle married his wife, who was English, and she was living over there, they decided to host Christmas for everybody. So what they do is they prepare huge quantities of food. They put it all out on tables. All the family came around, just the close family, because she was new, so no need to scare her. So about 25 people. And, everybody has some food. They sit around the table. And then she said, would anybody like any more before I bring dessert out? And everybody declined, and so she cleared everything away and came back carrying the pudding, and there was just a stony silence in the room. Everybody sat very quietly eating their pudding and left. Now, what's the problem with this picture? Well, it's culture. You are required to refuse to be polite. Oh, no, 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 really, I couldn't. I'm full. Second time round. No, 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 really, I couldn't. I'm full. Now, the third time you're asked, now you go back and you have 2 to 3 times as much food as you did on the first visit, because the host cannot run out of food. That's embarrassing to the host. So in order not to embarrass the host, everybody takes just a little bit. And when the time comes, and it's the right time, everyone's had some, and you're allowed back, now you pack up your plate, you know, 4 feet high, and you eat to your heart's content. And sometimes, for some people, believe that understand what the Christian faith is, the invitation has to be repeated over and over and over again. Are you sure you wouldn't like to come? We're doing this. You know, we'd love to see you there. Why don't you come along to the Alpha course we're running? And it's not just enough sometimes to say once. Because you don't know what's going on in someone's heart mind. The question is, do they know that this is actually really believed? Now, when the servant comes back into the room, he says something very interesting. He says, Master, what you have ordered has been done, but there is still room. And the servant now begins to capture something of the master's vision. The servant comes into the room and he says, everybody you told me to bring, I brought them, but there are still empty seats. And the servant now realizes something. This master is determined that every seat will be occupied. There won't be a single empty seat at this feast. So he's saying, God, what do you want done next? And the master says, you go out into the highways and byways. You go out way beyond this community. You go to all the communities which are a long, long way off. You find them and you bring them. Now, any Jewish reader of this gospel would immediately understand that this is referring to the Gentiles. Hey, first of all, you go within the community. You find everyone who's near. Now you go a long way away. You find everyone who's afar off. You find them. You tell them to come too. Have you ever thought how difficult that is? I mean, how would you know that this is true? Can you imagine someone saying, please come to this banquet, my master wants you there, and you go, are you telling me that someone I've never heard of, who doesn't know me, and I've got no idea what you're talking about, is insisting that I'm there? Does that sound believable to you? That sounds incredible. To a lot of people, the Christian faith, the Christian invitation sounds unbelievable, incredible. It can't possibly be true, can it? Sounds like some crazy fantasy. Or even worse, some kind of sick practical joke. Could you imagine making the huge journey, you arrive and everyone falls about laughing, there's another one of those idiots. Can you believe they came all this way for nothing? That's a perfectly acceptable response. And you're going to have to be able to answer those questions. No, it is true. It is real. It is meant. This is actually for you. Maybe you're sat here this morning and you would describe yourself as not being a Christian. Well, you'll find, amongst other things, what this church does is it does do things like this thing called the Alpha Course, designed to allow people to come in and find out, is it true? Is it real? Is it for me? Does it make any difference? Why not find out if it's real? Because what has been offered at the end of this story is incredible. 2 things are said. First of all, the master says, I tell you, those who were invited and didn't come, they won't even taste my banquet. Now, the imagery is very strong. After the invited guests sit around and they help themselves, any uninvited guests can come into the house and just hoover up. Does that make sense? Because you can't keep the food. Okay, so you have to cook more than enough to make sure everybody has enough. Then you feed all of your guests until they can't eat anymore. So what do you do with everything else? Well, hospitality. Hey guys, I got loads and loads and loads of stuff in the house. Just come. Everyone in the community comes and they taste all the delicacies you prepared. After that has been done, you throw it out and the animals eat it. Okay, because there's no point binning it. You know, you may as well feed the livestock. Even the animals and the wild dogs taste it. So when Jesus says they won't even get a taste, the imagery is really, really strong. He's saying, look, there are a group of people out there who think they have a ticket to heaven. They think they have an invitation to the banquet of the resurrection of the righteous, the most important meal that will be thrown that the world has ever seen. And those people who think they have this, they're in the process of excusing themselves from coming. But Jesus says there are a whole bunch of other people out there who think they're not worthy or they're not honorable or they haven't heard or they're not sure if it's even true. And actually, they're going to end up coming. Now, the implications are profound. We're living in a world that's struggling to find peace. We're living in a world where people are wondering, is it really possible to find forgiveness for what I have done? Which does restore a sense of self-worthiness. To find peace with other people and even to find peace with God. Now, we're not often so sure about peace with God. We're not even sure if it can be found in this world. That's why we put it on people's tombstones, rest in peace. That's when people think you finally find it. Does that make sense? It's a bit like, have you ever watched that great philosophical commentary on culture called The Simpsons? Have any of you seen that? There's this one scene where Homer Simpson's talking to God and he says, God, why am I here? And God says, oh, Homer, I can't tell you that until you die. And Homer says, oh, I can't wait that long. And God says, you can't wait for 6 more months? Is that when we find answers to those kinds of questions? In the person of Christ, he's actually offering to answer that question now. He's offering us an answer to that question now. You can find peace. And you can find it with me, God says, because of who Christ is and why he's come. So if you're on the outside looking in, at the very least, I'll say, why not try and take time to find out who Jesus Christ is and why he came? It could well be the most important question you ever answer in your entire life. Now, for the majority of you, I'm a guest here, so I've got no idea whether there are visitors here or not. I'm going to assume that you often come to this church, or you sort of come to this church, whatever it is, you're Christians. And I guess I have 2 questions for you. The first one is to do with the status of your own invitation before God. What does it truly mean for you to be a Christian? Do you feel that one day you got a ticket and you had it stamped, and one day when you need it, you can cash it in order to be with Jesus and God forever? Well, if that's your only view of the Christian faith, the chances are you probably haven't fully understood it yet. But there's a bigger issue here, because every parable that Jesus Christ ever told demanded a response. The people that Jesus is speaking to are all people who believe in God. They're talking about the banquet of the resurrection of the righteous. And Jesus says there was a man who threw a great banquet. I mean, the parallels aren't hard to find. Okay? That means the host is God. So who are the servants? Well, that would be you lot. What is the servant's response in the parable? The servant's response in the parable is, Master, there is still room. Where would you have me go? And so the question is, where is God sending you? Maybe he's sending you just down the street to go and find someone who would just love to talk to you. Would just love to talk to anyone, to be honest. Would love to come along to Alpha. Or he's sending you to get involved with CAP, which is an amazing organization. I think my wife would say, she heard one of the leaders of CAP being interviewed on Radio 4 the other day, and the leader was saying something along the lines of, well, she said, well, how can you help people forgive all this debt? And she said, well, we can help them forgive just not monetary debt, but there's even a much bigger debt that we all need to be forgiven for all the things we've done wrong. And that's what motivates us in CAP. And the interviewer listened to this person speak for 3 minutes, and at the end said, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. Isn't that incredible? Maybe he's sending you further away, but wherever it is, he's sending you somewhere. There is a reason why he brought you here. It's more than just to have coffee and croissants. He's sending you. And the question is, will you respond? Will you say yes? A couple of years ago, there was a guy, we run a training center in Oxford where we help train people in what's called Christian apologetics, and trying to answer people's difficult questions. And we do like a 1-year program. We do a short program, five year, short for Oxford, a five week program, normally for businessmen and women, okay? To help them share their faith in the workplace. And this guy applied, and he had an interesting job. His previous employer was the British Army. And he was 17 and a half years in the SAS. And I remember saying to him, I said, why is it you want to come and do this program? And he said, well, Michael, I've heard about some of the parts of the world you go to, because I go to some more difficult parts of this world. He says, and I would like to go to those parts too, and I think this training would help me go there. And so the guy, he comes and does the training with us, and at the end I said to him, well, look, would you like to come with me? I'm going to a particular country, I better not name it, but we went to this very difficult country together. And for those of you who want to put all the stuff together, we're going to go and visit the place where if any of you can remember back as far as the London bombing in 07, we went to go and speak in the school they were trained in, where those hostile guys were trained in, to go and talk to them about who Christ was. And we're standing in line to go through immigration, and I'd never thought of the question before. I don't know why. I turned to him. I said, have you ever been to this country before? He said, oh, yes, many times, but I've never been through passport control. Just dropped in from a great height. And we had the most incredible week there. We saw some incredible people's lives turned around. People whose life was bent on nothing but death and destruction, suddenly finding love and forgiveness and now living a totally different way. We met another guy who, after his conversion to the Christian faith, had gone out publicly to tell people about Jesus, and the police had come along and lifted him up off the hair by two guys grabbing his hair and lifting him up off the floor, and they literally pulled out the hair by its roots. And he hit the floor, and as he was telling the story, his friend took his skull cap off, and you could see the bald patches either side of his head. They beat him, threw him in prison, and while he was in prison, he thought, well, gosh, these prisoners can't go anywhere, and he'd only been a Christian for a week. And so he quoted Psalm 23 to them, sang them a few songs, and said, let me tell you about how amazing Jesus is. At 4 a.m., the prison warden came, pointed to this guy, and said, I'm going to throw you out of my prison because you're causing trouble, which is normally the very reason you put people in trouble, if you think about it. And as they opened the gate, some of the other prisoners grabbed him and said, you can't leave until you pray for us. And I can remember thinking, gosh, so many people in England, they give up sharing their faith because they're a bit worried about being embarrassed. And they think they had a bad experience in the past. This was this guy's first experience of telling anyone about Jesus Christ. And this is what he does full time now, for all of his life. And as we were on the plane back, I turned to this guy, he was sat next to me, and I said, was it worth it? Was it worthwhile you going through all of this, flying all of this way, being part of this? And he welled up with tears. And he said, this is what I want to be doing with my life. He said, when I was in the SAS, he said, I did everything the British government asked of me, because I was with a group of people who were totally committed to the vision. And there was nothing too difficult, nothing too hard. There was no sacrifice we weren't prepared to make to achieve the vision and the mission that had been put before us. He said, now I've become a Christian. What God is asking of me is more important than any mission any government has ever sent me on. He said, but where's the commitment? Where's the willingness to sacrifice? Where's the commitment to each other, where we all have each other's backs, to be able to go and do the difficult things? He said, I want to be part of a church where we're living for something much bigger and greater and more challenging than that. He says, and this is why I'm here. He says, it's absolutely been worth it. So as we close out our time together, I'd like to end on those two notes of invitation. The first one is, as I say, if you're here as a visitor, as a non-Christian, why not take the time to find out if this is actually true? Because if what is implied here is true and it's real, and you're being invited to be part of something which is both bigger and could totally change your life, look into it. But if you're sat here as a Christian, I guess my question would be, are you satisfied with your Christian walk? Were you hoping that somehow it would be bigger than this, better than this, more extensive than this, deeper than this, greater than this? Well, you're only going to get into this partly what you're prepared to commit to. In any relationship, if you're not committed, not very much happens. But when you're committed, it goes way, way deeper and further than you could ever imagine. And Christ is inviting you to be part of one of the greatest missions, to attend one of the greatest banquets that's ever been held. And if you can see there are empty rooms at the banquet table, then he can use you to make sure that every single one of those is filled. God loves this world. He doesn't want anyone to be passed by. And he's planning to invite as many people as possible, and he's planning to start with you. Why don't I just pray? Father, I want to thank you for this time we've been able to have together. Lord, we've looked at some big issues and we've looked at some difficult questions. But Lord, most of all, we know, Father, that you do require and ask of a response from all of us. Lord, whether it's to find out, Lord, or whether it's to go. And Father, I want to pray, Lord, for everyone here in this room, Lord, that they may just find out just how wide and deep things with you go if we fully give ourselves over to you. And Lord, we thank you that your love for us isn't conditional on our response, but our experience of your love very much is. And Lord, we want to be fully immersed in all that you have for us and all you intend for us. And will you open our eyes afresh to everything you have before us? Amen.